Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. $68 billion, that's billion with a B. That is the latest budget shortfall projection from the nonpartisan LAO, or Legislative Analyst Office, on where California stands financially as we head into the new year. The budget shortfall has ballooned. Last year, the gap was $31 billion. Now it's more than double. Of course, the big question is why and how did we get here? The tougher question is what needs to be done to get us out of this financial hole? If there is any good news to all of this, the state's financial analysts would not go as far as calling this a crisis and said California is in a better position now to handle it than in years before. Cap Radio state politics reporter Nicole Nixon is going to walk us through the budget shortfall and explain what could get California back on a healthy financial track. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
Okay, so $68 billion, not a crisis, according to state analysts. You know, who are they?
The legislative analyst, Gabe Pettick, says this is not a crisis. The Legislative Analyst's Office, like you said, it's a nonpartisan entity. There's about 50 analysts who advise the legislature on fiscal and policy issues in that office. They play a big role in crafting the budget. They often give recommendations on policy and budget line items. Like you said, the $68 billion, the lead legislative analyst, Gabe Pettick, says it's not a crisis. So here's that.
I go with the word serious budget problem. And the reason for the distinction is the tools that the state has available that I've been mentioning, the reserves, the one-time spending, and the other options. And also the state remains in a good cash position, and that really wasn't the case back in the start of the Great Recession. And so we don't face the same kind of liquidity challenges that we had at that time. And so I would stop short of describing it as a crisis.
And just some other top line items from this budget outlook report. A big chunk of this deficit is actually for the current fiscal year we are in, about $26 billion. And then the LAO is also projecting operating deficits around $30 billion for the next 3 years in the state. So there's a lot of money problems for the legislature to figure out when they come back in January.
And I don't have to go that far back into history to when you joined us like a year or two ago and we had like a record budget surplus, and now we're on the opposite end of things. It's down to 180. So when it comes to a budget shortfall that we're currently facing, $68 billion, you know, when it comes to this magnitude, how does it stack up to previous years when California faced a deficit? I mean, is this significant when you go back like 10 or 20 years?
I mean, dollar-wise, this is for sure the largest budget deficit the state has ever faced. But the LAO says that compared to it, percentage-wise, you know, as a percentage of the entire budget, it compares to the dot-com bust or the Great Recession 20 years ago.
And didn't we just pass a budget for $31 billion not too long ago? What happened? How did we get here?
Yeah, the current budget included a deficit, or they filled a deficit of about $31 billion. But the state was already anticipating a budget for the next fiscal year. But this is like 4 to 5 times the size of that deficit they were planning for. And a lot of this has to do with last year's winter storms. I know, it's interesting to connect weather to a giant state deficit, but because there was so much severe flooding all around the state, the federal government pushed the tax filing deadline from April to the fall. It ended up being in November, and the state followed for uniformity. The state really relies on having those tax receipts in the spring so that they know how much money is coming in, what they can plan for. So those coming in so late in the year and being down so much really surprised a lot of folks, and here we are.
Yeah, and a delay like that going from April to November. I mean, I remember talking to the Department of Finance, and that was unprecedented. Something like this hadn't been done before. But did you get a better understanding of why they were so off with their projections and estimates?
Well, California is home to a lot of the wealthiest people in the country. Those people pay taxes at a much higher rate than you or I do. Usually in a good year, the top 1% is paying almost half of all state tax revenue. The LAO said that according to their early numbers, it's looking more like 40%. So the point here is when the highest earners in the state have a down year, the entire state budget really, really feels it.
Okay, so in addition to these tax receipts not looking how they were expected to look, but overall, when it comes to California's economy, it's still relatively strong. I know we are facing inflation and a higher and more strained cost of living, but how do these two things square up?
Well, this report actually shows a cooling economy. You have top earners making less money, getting less stocks and bonuses. Interest rates are up. They have been for a while. That means people are borrowing less. Home sales are down. That affects tax revenue. Investments in businesses are also down. The number of IPOs really contributed to those $100 billion surpluses a couple years ago, and that is way down the number of companies going public. Also, fewer Californians are employed right now than they were last summer in 2022. Sales tax is the sales tax revenue is also flat, even though prices are going up. A flat sales tax shows that people are not spending as much money. And all of these things are pointing to an economic slowdown and less tax revenue as a result.
OK, so if there's some foreshadowing of, you said, a cooling, it could even further slow down. I mean, this deficit is big enough that the governor could declare a budget emergency. If that happens, what does that allow lawmakers, you know, how does that help them in their ability to deal with this financial problem?
Yeah, well, as you heard Gabe Petek mention, we have a budget, a rainy day fund now that we did not have 20 years ago. So there's about $24 billion in there. A budget emergency would allow state lawmakers to take money out of that. It would also allow them to do this complicated maneuver with education funding. The state has to give, you know, a constitutional minimum for schools. They've been paying more than that minimum. A budget emergency would allow the state legislature to go back and kind of redo the math for the school year we're in right now. That means that schools would get less money, but they could take money out of a school a rainy day fund account and backfill that. And then that constitutional minimum for school spending, a budget emergency would let them, you know, use that minimum to give less money for schools, basically. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yeah, I mean, especially come the new year, I mean, some tough decisions likely will have to be made. And you mentioned the dot-com bust, you mentioned the Great Recession. I mean, during those periods, I mean, there were massive budget shortfalls and also budget battles when it came to, like, what to cut, and with legislators fighting over that funding. Do we expect the same kind of dynamic when the legislature returns?
Not to that extreme. I mean, back then there were, yeah, light budgets. Workers, state workers were getting IOUs. Since that time, voters approved new laws that, one, lowered the threshold to pass a budget. It used to be the legislature had to do a two-thirds majority on all budgets. That made it very difficult to get there. Now it's just a simple majority, which means the Democratic supermajority can easily pass a budget. Also, lawmakers don't get paid if they don't pass a balanced budget. That's a big incentive for them to get it done. And then in 2014, after the Great Recession, voters passed a law that requires this minimum amount of money to go toward the rainy day fund and paying down debt. So that is a big reason, that rainy day fund, why the state has big reserve accounts to help deal with this budget.
Okay, so although large, this budget deficit is different from others in the past. Have we heard from the governor on this? What is his expected next step when it comes to the budget?
We have not heard from the governor. He's actually skipped some public appearances since this big deficit news came out. Now, I'm not saying that that's directly related. He's had other things on his agenda. I don't know that he's been asked about it. His next step is in early January presenting his spending plan to the legislature.
Mm. You know, when it comes to what could potentially fall on the budget axe when it comes to certain areas of government spending, when talking with lawmakers, have you gotten an idea if there maybe would be cuts to education or infrastructure or other industries and agencies?
We don't know yet. I think it's still very early, and the budget is not due till June. You have lawmakers making statements saying that they want to protect core services like education. So that'll be something to watch. The Legislative Analyst's Office also says that there are ways the legislature could fill this deficit without making major cuts to ongoing programs. There's that school funding thing. There's budget reserves. There's about $9 billion that has been allocated, but it has not gone out the door yet. So they could stop that and pull it back to put toward this problem.
I would imagine there's also people who are critical of the state getting into this situation. I mean, when you hear from lawmakers who, you know, have argued that California is just spending its way into these budget shortfalls, I mean, what are they saying?
Well, you have Republicans definitely saying, blaming the Democrats who control the legislature and the Democratic governor for runaway spending. I talked to Senator Roger Nilo. He's local in Fair Oaks, and he's the top Republican on the Senate Budget Committee. Here's what he had to say.
every 5 to 7 years, we go through this cycle. And while we're better prepared for it now than we were in 08, 09, we do have a reserve. It's not adequate to fill the gap. We've made it worse by the budget that we adopted for the current year. And we have a very significant hill to climb.
And then you heard Senator Nilo mention that we made it worse. That's because the legislature passed a budget that was expecting a deficit for next year. So, you know, their argument is that Democrats are spending, not putting as much away and spending on one-time programs. Also, a kind of scorching statement from James Gallagher, the top Republican in the assembly. He blamed Newsom as a checked out governor, I'm quoting now, who's more interested in chasing the national spotlight than the business of running the state. Also pointing out that the size of the state budget overall has grown so much over the past 5 years, and they just call it irresponsible.
Well, and Nicole, obviously this budget deficit is running into a big election year, 2024. Do you think this could be an opportunity for Republicans to kind of seize this opportunity and say, hey, this is more of the same from Democrats?
Absolutely. You're already seeing that. Republicans blaming Democrats for spending, for taking this golden goose of $100 billion surpluses and turning it into a $58 billion deficit. Now, do state lawmakers have control over the economy at large and interest rates? No. But Republicans argue that the state could be doing much more to foster a healthy business economy. Now, on the flip side, Democrats can use this to their advantage. They can craft a balanced budget. They can say, look at all these programs we saved from being cut. We saw that in 2020 when we were also looking at a big deficit because of the pandemic. They protected school funding. They put more money toward like distance learning and all of those things. So it will be interesting to see if Democrats make this backward looking adjustment to school funding. I mean, nobody wants to be responsible for cutting school funding, especially in an election year.
Yeah. Finally, Nicole, I mean, we're in the middle of this. What will the next several months look like when it comes to the budget?
Yeah. And I will say this report is very, it's very primary. You know, the tax receipt numbers just came in. So analysts are in the Newsom administration's Department of Finance. That's another thing I didn't mention is the LAO is the legislature's fiscal analyst. The Newsom administration has their own department looking at these numbers, and actually they may have a different number. Mm. So the governor's required to present a balanced spending plan in early January. After that, he and the top Democrats in the legislature will go into these really tough negotiations to figure out what to spend, if they're going to make cuts, and what those cuts would be. Later in the spring, the state will have an even better idea of its finances. That's assuming, again, though, that the tax deadline doesn't get pushed later in the year like it happened this year. And then the entire balanced budget is due in June, just ahead of the new fiscal year in July.
A lot of dynamics at play.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thanks.
Nicole Nixon is Cap Radio state politics reporter explaining California's projected $68 billion budget shortfall and where it stands today. Up next, the USDA announced a new push with funding attached to help train the next generation of farmers and ranchers. And one of those recipients is right here in Sacramento. We'll learn about it. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. When it comes to putting food on our plates, whether in the U.S. or abroad, millions of people across the country have dedicated their lives to the agricultural industry. But the number of farms in the country is on the decline, and the workforce is aging. One-third of the country's farmers are over the age of 65. So the USDA is working to train the next generation of farmers and ranchers, and at the same time, make that industry more diverse. Recently, the USDA announced that nearly $28 million will be going to programs to help people who are just starting their careers in agriculture. And some of that money is coming here to Sacramento to support a new project that is being launched by the California Bountiful Foundation to support beginning farmers who are veterans or come from socially disadvantaged backgrounds. Jim Houston is with the California Farm Bureau, which runs the California Bountiful Foundation, and Michael O'Gorman is the founder of the Farmer Veteran Coalition, which is a partner on the project. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Vicki.
Good morning, Vicki.
Good morning. Okay, Jim, I want to start with you because California was the top producing agricultural state in the country last year. It's a big footprint in California's economy. What are the top goods in California?
We are the largest agricultural state in the country. The numbers have not come out for this year, but preliminary estimates put them around just north of $60 billion. We have over 400 commodities that we grow here, and our top ones, interestingly enough, are dairy by far, about $8 billion, wine grapes, and almonds, of course.
Mm. What does the California Farm Bureau do to help support the farm and ranching industry in the state?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, people might not know a lot about the California Farm Bureau, but every county in the state, with the exception of Alpine, which only has 70 residents, has a county farm bureau. We actually just last week introduced the San Francisco Farm Bureau to complete the state. And each one of those helps the farmers in their network or in their county with the problems of the day, the latest technology, the latest techniques, markets, et cetera, working with local governments. And the California State Farm Bureau helps those 54 county farm bureaus with their job. And then we also, of course, talk to state legislators, regulators, the governor, et cetera, to help them understand the problems of the farm.
Okay, so given that you just added San Francisco as a farm bureau for that region, I just can imagine just such a diverse patchwork of farm bureaus across the state, from the Central Valley to the North Coast, you know, down to Southern California, and of course, the Sacramento region.
Yeah, it is really a unique group and a wonderful opportunity. And it's one of the things that we're most excited about, connecting that diverse group of people with this program and helping our next generation of farmers and ranchers tap into that knowledge base and the opportunities there.
Where does the California Bountiful Foundation fit into this?
So the California Bountiful Foundation is the 501c3 offshoot of the California Farm Bureau. And it looks at a whole host of things, water supply, water use, climate change, and you know, how ag interacts with climate change. People might not know that plants actually suck carbon out of the air and create, you know, food and fiber from that. And so we work to enhance that. And this was one of the programs that the California Bountiful Foundation does, which is to help the next generation. We call it sustainability squared. So where you're both sustainable in your operation. But, you know, I mean, you need to be able to sustain your business. You need to be able to make a profit, pay people, pay off your mortgage, and hopefully leave something for the next generation.
Yeah. Well, Michael, that brings me to you. You have a lot of farming experience throughout the state. I mean, how did you start farming?
I just started farming as a first generation farmer, which is, I think it gives me a little bit of understanding our need for more farmers and how farmers can get into this career. In 1990, when the demand for organic production jumped overnight, I was there and was hired to manage the first organic farm in Salinas. And then I spent the next 20 years building three of the country's largest organic vegetable companies as their production manager. And then I went on to start the Farmer Veteran Coalition.
Yeah, that was going to lead me to that. What led to you founding this coalition?
Well, it was some personal and some understanding our need for more farmers. But the personal end was my oldest daughter of my four children was at ground zero crossing the street when the plane hit. First plane hit, she got away uninjured, but traumatized. And my son went and joined the military a week later. And so after 11 years of managing the last company that I was in charge of here in Baja California, I decided to do something totally different and start an effort to help military veterans become farmers.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does farming help veterans, you know, once they have completed their service?
You know, the first thought, you know, they need something to do. And the first thought of a lot of people is farming. Oh, how bucolic, that must be so healing. And as if those of us who farm know that
it's stressful.
Yeah. It's stressful and demanding. And what the veterans taught me was that was the difficulty of it was part of the challenge. And the real reward came that it gave them a sense of purpose, something as important as serving in the military, and the sense of farming and feeding people as a for our national security, for our economic security, for the growth and health of our rural communities where many of them come from. And so it's been a really, really tremendous fit.
Well, the foundation, the California Bountiful Foundation, received $500,000 from the USDA for this new program that we're going to be talking about. And that's really to educate farmers and ranchers that are starting off to support them and offer them resources. How did the idea for this project come about, Jim?
Yeah, that's actually kind of an interesting story. So we actually hosted, this is probably 2 years ago, a forum at the California Farm Bureau headquarters put together at the request of CDFA, because this was actually during the pandemic where we were coming out of the pandemic and the state wasn't allowing people like into their building. And so they wanted to use our building to host it. And so USDA and CDFA had it, and they came in on Zoom, and we had 35 farmers and ranchers in the building and then probably another 20 on Zoom. And they were all socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers. And the CDFA and USDA and the government folks are up there, and God bless them all, but they're talking about, you need to get this certification or that to sell to Walmart or Costco. And I'm looking at this person, and they have like 35 acres, and they're not going to be selling to Costco and Walmart with 35 acres anytime soon. And so all this was well-intended, but I realized that there was this gap of the real sort of producer who's out there, who's on the field, who's in the county, who's day-to-day facing the challenges. And how, what do they know? What are their lessons? And how do we connect these new people? Because, you know, farming is a really interesting thing is, you know, I have kids. I have a 13 and 10-year-old. And if they want to become a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, a coder, as my son likes to talk about, then they know how to do that. They know how to go to school. If they want to become a farmer, what do I do,
right?
And so we need farmers from urban and suburban lands, people who have not been farmers traditionally, to come in, and we need to make it as easy as possible for them to see, here's the steps that you take, here's where you can get a loan, here's where you start, here's where to get a cheap truck, because you're going to have to haul stuff, and up from there. And so that's really what the inspiration was, is how do we take our 20,000 farms, who 80% of them are small farms, and connect them with this next generation.
Michael, I'm sure you can speak to that. You're a first generation farmer. I would imagine there was a pretty steep learning curve when you jumped into it.
Absolutely. A super, steep learning curve. And I was lucky to survive, some early on crashes and mistakes. But to speak to what Jim's saying and the Farm Bureau, I've been working with the Farmer Veteran Coalition. I started with just a handful of veterans, and it's grown into a national organization with 46,000 veterans who are either started to farm or interested in farming. And there's a lot of organizations out there that have funding to help train them, but there's nowhere where they can get the training that they can get from an existing farm that it's not just the knowledge of farming. There's a pace to it. There's just a million different things that they're going to learn from working alongside someone who has that experience and has an operational farm that has to pay its bills and survive. And so it's a great fit.
When it comes to the $500,000 that you're getting from the USDA, how many farmers and ranchers could this help, Jim?
So the goal is to help 200 farmers and ranchers, connect 200 young farmers and ranchers with 200 mentees.
Oh, wonderful. And is there a span? I know you're probably just scaling up, like how long this can last?
Yeah, so we're going to start in February accepting applications, and then the program lasts 3 years. So 1 year is ramp up time, and then 2 years of operation. So we expect to have 2 years of mentors, so 200 a year, so 400 total.
When it comes to a beginning farmer or rancher, I would imagine it's not just like 1 or 2 years in, that it can take several years before you get some experience or even even are considered a veteran farmer and rancher.
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's 0 to 10 is the operating window. And to your point, you know, when you plant almond trees or walnut trees or pistachio trees, you're not getting production for 5 to 7 years. And so, you know, organic production, you have to fallow your land for 3 years where you can't apply anything. And so the productivity is severely decreased. So there's a lot of that time. And then, you know, if you're a cherry farmer, right, you get one good year in five. So allowing that 10 years allows for folks to sort of, you know, have some of those initial experiences, but you're still, even at 7 years, kind of a beginning farmer.
So with this funding, will some of that funding go to the individual if you're wanting to help up to 200 farmers and ranchers? Or what will the money go towards? I know mentorship, but also programs as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, as a statewide organization with only 500,000, to be honest, that's not a whole lot. And so what it really does is it helps support the time for the counties. So if a county is going to have a meeting, it'll help pay for the room and for the materials there. It'll help pay for some of the consulting time for the mentors. But the mentees, really, the benefit they have is the knowledge. And then there are lots of programs at the state that we'll inform them about that will help them get some of that initial funding that might be required for capital purchases.
And I know this program is really targeting and focusing on people who are veterans, but also people who come from socially disadvantaged backgrounds. What does that exactly mean? Is there a concrete definition for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there is a concrete definition at USDA, which is a historically marginalized group. So we break it down, or USDA breaks it down: Native Americans, African Americans, Native Hawaiians, Asian, Hispanic, Latino, Spanish are the available. And Middle Eastern is in there as well. They're just not a census count for USDA.
Is there a difference between California's distinction and the federal distinction for socially disadvantaged?
Yeah, interestingly enough, women are not included in the USDA definition, but they are in the California definition. So because we're in California, we include women as part of that.
Hmm. Michael, what excites you about this funding?
I'm excited to help veterans find somebody to match up and to learn from, and the wealth of experience that those 30,000-40,000 Farm Bureau members have across the state is just, you know, it's just the greatest thing they could be tapping into. You know, they're starting out. There's a network. Farmer Veteran Coalition has just launched a new chapter in the state, and a lot of these men and women are just getting started. Some of them are some years into it, but could use the help. So just the matching of somebody with that could take them a little bit under their wing, and they could call if they're something's going awry on their farm or they need some direction, and is a fantastic thing. It's the best thing a young farmer can have is somebody to help them mentor.
How instrumental and valuable was that for you when you were getting your start?
It's extremely valuable. I learned from neighbors. I was really good at watching and not afraid to go ask. It was other farmers that taught me, even though I was early on organic, you know, they recognized that, you know, that wasn't a, first and foremost, I was a farmer and a fellow farmer, and they recognized what I was doing, and they recognized my work ethic, and I never found a farmer unwilling to help.
Jim, in addition to partnering with Michael and his coalition, what other organizations is the California Farm Bureau working on this project and collaborating with?
Yeah, certainly we have the Farmer Veteran Coalition because we aim to get 30% of the mentees to be veterans. And then we're working with the Black Agricultural Working Group headed by Michael Harris to reach out to Black farmers in the area. Interestingly enough, at the 2017 count for USDA, there were only 599 Black farmers in California, and so we'd really like the 2022 count to go up from there. And then we're working with the Young Farmers and Ranchers Committee to do outreach into the counties as well.
Given that California, I think, is the most diverse state in the country, if not, it's at the top. Do you have a sense of how diverse California's farming and ranching population is?
Yeah, we do. I mean, it's a little bit old. The data is from 2017. And so we hope that these numbers will be, you know, they'll be different, some better, some worse. The number of farms will be worse because it'll be smaller. But this is based on 70,000 farms. So there's 11,000 Hispanic Latino owned farms, which is about 16%. 60% of our farms actually have female operators, not exclusively, but they have a female as part of their management structure, like senior management structure. 4,000 farms are run by Asian Americans, 2,000 Native Americans, as I mentioned, 599 African Americans, and then 568 Native Hawaiians. And so it is a diverse, but certainly not reflective of the diversity of California.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jim Houston from the California Farm Bureau and Michael O'Gorman for the Farmer Veteran Coalition about a new project to grow the number of socially disadvantaged and veteran farmers in California. You know, Jim, I think you mentioned there's like 10,000 farms across the state. Is that correct?
70,000.
70,000 farms across the state. I mean, when I led with this conversation, I mean, nationwide, I mean, the population is aging. I believe a third of farmers are over the age of 65. You know, how are we seeing that shake out here in California? Is that pretty much along the same lines?
Yeah. In fact, our membership, you know, we lose 5% of our membership every year due to, you know, people sadly passing away and consolidation. That's the other sort of, you know, thing that folks don't talk about is consolidation. As a small farm, you know, when a small farm goes out of business, it generally gets eaten by a larger farm. And so one of the things that's really important for us is to have that competition, to have that new innovative blood coming in. They're hunger, they've got ideas. They're also sometimes, you know, more attuned to the up their generation, right? And so having that ideas and having that competition is of critical importance for us as consumers to continue to benefit from the food. And, you know, so as California goes, so goes the nation and the world with its food supply.
Is the reason why there's been more consolidation is because, I mean, I would think just even with a small business, just being a small farm or a small ranch, getting your start, I mean, it's a tough business. And as you said, it could take up to a decade before you kind of get into a healthy financial momentum.
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of a weird thing. I mean, I've been up here in Sacramento for almost 25 years doing ag policy. And it's almost so sort of like every step that we take, you know, it's not intentional, but it sort of disadvantages the small farm, right? If we've got more regulations, it's harder to, and it's not to say that we don't need regulations, but it's just, you know, compliance with those, input costs, the barriers to entry continue to raise. And so as a small farmer, you're sort of already a disadvantage. And a lot of times it's just easier if you've got a good idea, just like in the tech world, you know, if you've got a good idea, somebody bigger is going to come and they're going to buy your idea. But like I said, it's continuing to have those opportunities for folks to create that disruptive movement in agriculture.
And I can imagine it just could be hard to navigate and having the knowledge of how to navigate, which is why, you know, a project like this with mentorship could really help guide people to help kind of smooth out those hurdles.
Yeah, no, very much so. And understanding where to get the right financing, where the proper markets are, what to watch out for, because there are, it's business. And so there are people who, you know, are going to try and, you know, put you out of business. And so I think having that sort of mindset, but to you know, Michael's point, and farming is such a wonderful occupation. You know, to be out there, to be working with your hands, to be working with nature, to produce something that, you know, like I said, I have kids. I mean, my son and daughter are literally constructed from the food and the milk that is grown by these farmers, and they're consumed, their bones, their mud. I mean, that's just a really remarkable opportunity, and you're sucking down carbon while you're doing it.
You know, Michael, you mentioned that, you know, the coalition that you founded for veteran farmers, I mean, it's grown nationwide. You serve tens of thousands of farmers who are veterans. You know, when it comes to, you know, the opportunities you'd like to see here when it comes to California's agriculture, where do you see the opportunities for today's military veterans?
Well, I see them in two places. In one is in farm business, you know, in business ownership and a farming business. And there's a lot of business opportunity too, that a lot of ways to get into agriculture that don't involve a large amount of land, or could, you know, the companies I managed were huge. They was all rented land. So there's opportunities and ways to get into a farm business. The other is into farm employment. And sometimes that employment and that training you get from employment can lead to your own business. So both of them are sorely needed. And, you know, we need to replace our farmers and our business owners, but we also need to bring in a generation of skilled employees into the farms, you know, the people that run the irrigation and drive the equipment and operate the equipment and manage crews and run the offices. So there's we see them both places.
You mentioned that, you know, it gives veterans a sense of mission and purpose. You know, I would imagine that there's even, you know, just working with your hands and being outside, there's a mental health component as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, when we really saw that was during COVID. You know, when COVID hit that first week, my phone just blew up by calls from veterans all across the world and across the country. You know, they were losing markets. You know, they had they sold at farmers markets and they were shut down. They sold hotels and the hotels weren't buying. They had to farm to school and the schools weren't buying. They were going crazy. And then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, people found their markets and the idea that they could be there, you know, like Jim mentioned with his kids, you know, they could be outside with their kids and seeing crops grow and seeing animals be born you know, the unity of family that it gave them. And it was just really rewarding to see that, you know, them go through that change and seeing that what a wonderful opportunity and what a wonderful lifestyle. So the lifestyle is very appealing. They're willing to work hard and like to do something where you can really tangibly see the result of your own efforts. So it's rewarding, but it's difficult. And that's where we come in. If they're willing to put in the work, we want to help.
Jim, I mean, someone's listening to this and they'd like to get in touch and they're interested in becoming part of this. How do they connect with you?
Wait until February, and then you can go to either CFBF.com, so, you know, CFBF, which is California Farm Bureau Foundation, California Farm Bureau Federation, or you can go to California CA Bountiful Foundation.com, which is the California Bountiful Foundation, to get more information.
Has something like this been done before? I mean, training the next generation of farmers with not only state but also federal funding attached to this?
I don't know if that has that total package has been done. There's certainly been, programs like this. The mentor program has been something that I think science, you know, sort of academic studies have pointed to as a successful model. But certainly this is the first in the nation that marries, you know, the organization that is so large, such as Farm Bureau, you know, with so to create that statewide opportunity and then to have the state and federal government contributing as well. You know, I think with that scale and that opportunity, it is really unique.
Jim and Michael, thank you so much for the time.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Vicky. Thank you.
Jim Houston is the administrator of the California Farm Bureau, and Michael O'Gorman is the founder of the Farmer Veteran Coalition. And they've been talking about a new program that is being launched by the California Bountiful Foundation to train the next generation of socially disadvantaged and veteran farmers and ranchers. Still ahead, it is jazz, swing, burlesque with a touch of the Harlem Renaissance all rolled into one, and it has become a holiday tradition in Sacramento. Peter Petty joins us with Hepcat's Holiday Swing and Yuletide Review. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We are well into holiday music this month. And if you're craving something different, the Crest Theater this weekend may be just what you're wanting to experience. Peter Petty has been performing in Sacramento for years, and his upcoming event with a 12-piece orchestra has really become a holiday tradition, inspired by one part swing era, two parts jazz, which when shaken up or stirred can make for a lively evening, where you can easily get up off your feet and dance the night away. Bandleader Peter Petty returns ahead of his annual Hepcats Holiday Swingin' Yuletide Review at the Crest Theater. It's happening this Saturday, December 16th at 7:30 p.m. Nice to see you, Peter.
It's so good to see you too, Vicky, as I live and breathe. Thank you so much for having me back.
I love this tradition on Insight, you coming at this time of year.
As do I. Well, I consider it a personal mitzvah on your part to have me back, so thank you so much. And that Shaken and Stirred cocktail you were talking about, that's called a Peter Petty Teeny.
I saw that.
And they will be in the house.
They have the Crest
Theater.
Drink
up, Jack, drink up.
How many years have you been doing this?
This is our eighth expression, I believe, of this particular program. Always different to Christ, but yeah, this is number eight for us.
And this is just one part of what you do here in Sacramento. Where did your love for jazz come from?
Indeed. Well, it came from a growing up with parents that listened to it all the time, and they were listening to the golden age of vocalists, really. So jazz, and my mom was huge into Dixieland. That's always what she wants. She's always let us know at her funeral she wants a second line playing Dixieland. And I'm like, Mama, why wait until the funeral? Let's just go out and see as much as we can in the interim. That was set in my bones early on, but I didn't really start getting more educated and more comprehensive about it until I was full grown. And then playing with jazz bands really set it deeper in me and really a more of an understanding of what it is and what it represents as a social movement and an American art form, of course. So it's just, yeah.
What's also interesting is, I mean, obviously you have a voice to go with it. You sang with the Sacramento Opera for 8 seasons.
Oh, I did. That's big talk, Vicky. But yes, I did. Eight seasons, eight glorious seasons. And in fact, I left Sacramento Opera to front another jazz orchestra leader in Sacramento. And then after 4 years with his band, I struck out on my own.
Wonderful. So this is your third year joining us ahead of Hepcats Holiday Swingin' Yuletide Review. It's been going on for 8 years now and counting. How did it all come about?
Well, I think really what started the impetus, this is when I was still with the previous sort of big band, Harry Connick Jr., great, to which everybody would love to compare themselves because he's just so damn successful. You know, he does it the way you think maybe you can. And he is, of course, no slouch. He really is. But he would do those like the big skating rink in New York City. So he'd put on those swing shows. And that just felt so good. I love the holiday season. Even coming here today, that crispness is in the air. It's just a quickening of your spirit. It just makes you want to share with others and just revel in that sense of shared humanity that is so important to our experience. And so I was always like, hey, let's do that. We got the skating rink downtown. Yeah. And so for years I was trying to get them interested because I wanted it to be like a free show, just a thing that everybody could come and do. And I could just never really get any traction with it. And so I figured I'm just going to have to put on my own show, I guess. And unfortunately, brother got to get paid, you know. So you know, we have to charge admissions. But that's kind of the impetus of it. It's just such a festive, merry time. And to feel it myself and to also feel it with others and know we're having that same kind of experience is invaluable.
Well, we're going to get a taste of it. We're going to listen to Boogie Woogie Santa Claus.
Okay.
Well, look ahead, Jack. Chuffing down the track, he got a rhythm in his feet, but nothing in his sack. The boogie woogie Santa Claus. The boogie woogie Santa Claus. The boogie woogie Santa comes to town every Christmas day. Well, he lives up in the mountain like a hermit in a cave. He never had a haircut, never took a shave. The boogie woogie Santa Claus. The boogie woogie Santa Claus. The
the boogie woogie Santa will boogie all your cares away.
You know, you reinterpret music. Walk us through your process. How do you make this all come to life?
Woo! Well, first of all, let's get excited.
Yes.
Vicky, because I can't, just hearing that, I'm bopping and
I don't know how
seat.
Anyone sits down during your show.
Else. At the Crest Theater, there's actually room for dancing. That's always been a hard
Wonderful.
Thing. Trying to get a dance floor as well as seating capacity has been a challenge. So we've sold out the Sophia Theater the last 2 years going. And so already we're at about the same amount of ticket sales as sold out the Sophia Theater. That's why we moved to the Crest, because it's about double capacity. So we got tickets for everybody this year. And room for dancing. That's very exciting. Now, what was your initial question?
Oh, reinterpreting music. How do you make it all come to life?
It is inevitable. I can't really help it. It's just the way I tend to feel it, and of course, I'm just riding on the shoulders of the giants that invented and perfected this milieu of sound. But it's just hard for me not to go that direction. Then maybe I can add a little bit of my own gestalt or whatever, but it's just, I just almost can't help it. There's not... It's funny, as I'm talking about, of course, I'm thinking about all the work that does go into it, but that's just part of the process. It really is. And of course, I am served so well by so many stalwart and steward musicians. These are just the best cats in the area that and most of these guys lead their own bands as well. You know, we're all mercenaries just helping each other out. And It's a lot of work now that I think about it. It's a great deal of work, and I got miles to go before I sleep before the show. But it's just in us.
Yeah.
It's in us. And Sacramento's a big jazz town. We go way back. You know, we're another river town. a lot of parallels to New Orleans and everything where this music came out of. And so it's just hard not to get it. And it's so joyous. It's so joyous that. When you're in the midst of it, you're there and it's real and it's happening and you are transported. So as far as interpreting it, it's I don't feel that it's necessarily that deliberate. Because when it's working, we're all on board and we're all communicating and loving it. You know?
Well, we're going to listen to it working right now. We're going to take a listen to That's What I Want for Christmas.
All right. Anyone can wish for all the trinkets in the window. Some can even buy the things they see. But the present that I want, it can't be found in any window. Bring me love and bring it just for me. Come home at night. Take me in your arms and hold me and kiss me and say you love me. Love me. Oh, love
and I would be remiss if we didn't talk about your 12-piece Mercenaries of Mary Jazz Orchestra.
Yeah, all right.
What do you love about them? How long have you guys been playing together?
Well, again, as I said, it's an amalgamation of mercenaries, so it's not always the same merry mercenaries, but mostly it's a core group that plays with me, and so we've been since 2012 is when I came out the chute trying to lead my own band. And so these, again, are these, in so many ways, I consider them mentors of mine, just because I don't have the musical education that they have. So my stuff is highly interpretive, and I break a lot of rules that it's a good thing you don't know exists, because otherwise you wouldn't be doing what you do. That really can make some magic sometimes, with everybody trying to, like, figure out how to insinuate this, this screaming banshee that is me into keeping it musical and beautiful. And like that last tune, oh, what a lovely song that is. And we do. We're going to bring the room down a few times, too, and give people time to reflect and everything. But that song is very significant to me because these songs you're playing are off my EP that I did for the Christmas show a couple years back. And I remember when I brought, when it was all, you know, in hand, and I brought it to my parents. My dad had been ill all year. And so we played the song for them in their bedroom. And my dad was just sitting there in bed listening to it. And we all started crying listening to that beautiful song. And indeed, that was the year that my dad passed. Oh. And so to have that, and the sweet and simple sentiment of just love me, you know.
Peter, thank you so much. That's a wonderful way to end.
Peter Petty
will be giving us a taste, or gave us a taste, of his annual Hepcats Holiday Swingin' Yuletide Review. It's happening at the Crest Theater Saturday, December 16th, 7:30 p.m. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Have a great rest of your day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.